Hello everyone. Happy New Year and welcome to the fifth episode of Your Brain in the Time of COVID-19, where we explore the neuroscience behind the emotions we're experiencing in this pandemic. I'm Gaia.
This is Emily. Long time no see. Happy New Year. In this episode, we're going to chat about how our brains will remember this unprecedented year. We will delve deep into the topic of memory, one of the coolest features of our extraordinary brains.
Woo! We'll also talk about how the lockdown is affecting our ability to remember parts of 2020. And with that, let's jump right into it. This is Your Brain in the Time of COVID-19, the remembering brain. I can't believe we have finally reached the end of 2020. It's so weird to think back to our life a year ago. It feels like a whole other era.
I know what you mean. I feel that I'm now a changed person. Can you believe we used to blow out candles on birthday cakes before sharing it with a huge group?
Yeah, honestly, it is making me so uncomfortable just thinking about that right
now. I know.
I would not touch that cake.
Right? What even is that life?
Last year was a lot.
It was. I feel like it has really forced me to think hard about my own work and identity and look at this world with a very different pair of eyes. I have to ask who I really am when I'm stuck at home, unable to fill my days with work or outings with friends. And I had to ask, what is the meaning and responsibility that comes with being a scientist? And when the hardest fights during this pandemic isn't the cutting edge science, but how to help the public understand or trust it.
Yeah, that's very true. I feel like, you know, the new year has always been a time for everybody to take stock and rewind and plan for the next year. One of my big plans is to be way more intentional this year, because honestly, for me, most of 2020 is just a mush up of like Zoom meetings and like literally nothing, not one particular thing stands out.
It brings to mind the question of how we would remember this year when we look back at this unprecedented period of time.
Yeah, I think memory, which we're discussing today, is one of the coolest features of our brain, and it's so important for our survival. It's the only reason we don't remain naive like a baby for our entire lives. We're capable of learning from our experiences and our mistakes because we can remember them.
So true. That is so important, especially for this year. Moreover, memory with loved ones is also the most precious thing we hold on to tightly. I feel that it is what really gives meaning to our lives.
Absolutely. However, this wonderful feature of our brain also comes with its own pitfalls. Believe it or not, our memories can be wildly inaccurate. We can also be haunted by unpleasant memories that interfere with our daily lives,
which we will go into more details later in this episode. We also want to talk about how memory came to exist in the biological world and as a concept,
and how this pandemic and the lockdown has thrown our ability to remember just a little bit off.
Let's do this.
Memory for me is definitely one of the more enigmatic and fascinating topics in neuroscience.
Definitely. In fact, our fascination with memory goes way, way, way back. Even before we know there's this thing in our head called the brain, we have been philosophizing about the concept of memory.
True. Memory is such an integral part of our lives. I'm kind of not surprised that ancient cultures took it upon themselves to try and understand it, you know?
Yeah, indeed. Plato himself had used many beautiful metaphors to try and capture what memory actually is. Plato and later his student Aristotle compared of memory to a wax tablet that our sensory experiences can imprint upon. In childhood, our wax tablet is very soft, and even the slightest sensory experiences could leave a deep mark. Therefore, we ended up not remembering anything in particular. But when we get older, however, our wax tablet would become hard and it's impossible to make any new imprint on them again.
Wow, that's such an interesting metaphor. And actually, I think it speaks quite nicely to the rigidity of our brain connections across lifespan.
Interestingly, Plato later also used birds in an aviary to describe memory. Could you maybe guess why?
Birds are beautiful. Oh, maybe something to do with the fact that they're very hard to catch.
You're spot on. Plato was speaking to the fact that sometimes retrieving memory can be very hard, even though they're not forever gone.
I love that.
Another thinker whose work advanced our understanding of memory is Charles Darwin himself. He proposed that memory is very likely not a uniquely human feature. It offers enormous survival advantage to animals trying to adapt to their environment, and it is a feature that is selected for in evolution.
I see. Oh, so for example, like what we talked about in the grief episode, if an animal has lost its pups near a river, it would really benefit them to remember that the river can be dangerous. That makes a lot of sense. But I have a question, Em. Do all animals have memory?
That's a really great question. The answer might surprise you. Memory is actually present in all animals with neurons or brain cells.
And all animals must have brain cells, right?
Sponges are also animals, but they actually don't have any brain cells.
Oh.
Although scientists have found that free swimming baby sponges do have cells that resemble brain cells to help them sense the surrounding environment before they settle down and stop swimming.
So cool. SpongeBob fans, take that as you will.
And I actually looked it up. So sea stars, on the other hand, do have brain cells. However, they don't have a centralized brain like we do in one place. Their brain cells are distributed throughout their bodies.
So what you're saying is Patrick does have memory.
I believe so.
Honestly, I have to say, that's still very hard to wrap my head around, you know? It might benefit us to remember who our friends and family are, like what fun things happened between us when we met the last time, etc. But what do animals even have to remember? Like, what did they use the memory for?
Since we cannot interview animals, it's actually very hard to say if they remember their life stories like us. However, there are other types of memories that are very useful for animals. For example, the tiny little translucent roundworms are able to remember in what kind of environment they're likely to find food. If, say, the roundworms found food regularly in a salty environment or an environment that smells sour or a warm environment, they would remember to always move towards salty taste, sour smell, and worms.
Ooh, because they associate the taste, the smell, or the temperature with food in their mind. On the other hand, if you've ever used a carrier to take your cat to the vet, good luck getting your cat into that same carrier again, because that cat has associated that carrier with unpleasant experiences.
Yeah, absolutely. Many animals actually have really amazing memories. For example, an elephant can build a mental map of the whereabouts of their entire family based on where it last smelt their urine.
Wow.
It can also remember where water sources are when it is on the move. And mammals are not the only ones with great memories. Many birds can remember where they buried their food, for example.
Wow. Wait a moment. What about fish? People always say you have the memory of a goldfish as an insult. Are they really that bad at remembering?
I'm really glad you asked. So there's an opportunity to restore their reputation. Scientists have found fish to have way, way better memory than what we give them credit for. So goldfish can remember its mealtime set by its owner, and guppies can even be trained to solve a maze.
Whoa.
Most amazingly, this will blow your mind. Archer fish are able to distinguish between different human faces.
So cool. So it's very likely your pet fish not only has memory way beyond 3 seconds, hey, they might even remember you.
Exactly. We gotta treat these amazing little critters with way more respect.
If It's really impressive how much animals can remember. But as you say, we cannot equate that with how vividly we remember where we were and what we were doing when we first heard the news of 9/11 or some other life-changing event, for example. Would you say then there are different types of memory?
You're exactly right. We actually use the word memory to describe a few different things, or as you said, a few different types of memory. For example, there are memories we can describe explicitly with words. They are called the declarative or explicit memory. For example, we can remember vividly what happened in our life, like an episode of TV drama. This is called the episodic memory. On the other hand, we can also remember things like Earth goes around the sun. This is called the semantic memory because it deals with concepts and facts.
Okay. Would you say that episodic memory is like remembering, you know, how our first Zoom gathering went during quarantine? And semantic memory is like remembering facts like, you know, keeping a 6 feet distance helps reduce the virus spread?
Absolutely.
Got it. Would you say there's a specific brain region then that is important for this type of declarative or explicit memory?
Yes. So the brain region is called the hippocampus, which is Latin for seahorse, which is the shape of this brain region. I still remember seeing it in a brain slice for the first time and was struck by the beauty of this structure and just in awe of the power within it. We learned that it is critical for the formation of new declarative memories.
So, if we got a stroke in this brain region, it would likely impair our ability to form new memories, but our old memories will be relatively intact, correct?
That is exactly what happened to a patient named HM who underwent a surgery for seizure. So the doctor was able to alleviate his seizure by removing a thumb-sized piece of the brain matter, the hippocampus. However, it was really a tragedy for HM because it turned out he was no longer able to form new memories about any new experience after the surgery. Although he was able still to keep most of his memories from before the surgery intact. So that was when we learned that the hippocampus is critical for forming new declarative memories.
Wow. Although I'm guessing there are also memories that don't exist verbally, are there? Was HM able to still form other forms of new memories?
Yeah, you're exactly right. For example, like birds can learn and perfect a specific song from their parent. And we can also remember actions we learned, like how to ride a bike or how to swim. The word muscle memory might come to mind, but this kind of memory is actually stored in our brain. And the scientific name for the term is procedural memory. So back to your question, HM is still able to form new procedural memories. So he can still learn new motor skills with no problems, because procedural memories seem to rely on not the hippocampus, but other brain structures, such as the cerebellum, meaning little brain, at the back of our head.
Oh, okay. So what about when a worm learns to follow a scent to get food, or when a fish follows a maze to find food?
This is another really, really powerful type of memory called associative memory. So advertisers love tapping into this kind of memories. For example, when we see the golden arches of McDonald's, the golden M, we start salivating because in our head it's associated with juicy burgers and crispy fries.
Oh, at least that's what they want us to think by bombarding us with ads that repeatedly associate the golden arches with images of burgers and fries. So what you're saying is we're all like Pavlov's dogs.
We are indeed like Pavlov's dogs in this sense. So Gaia, could you explain a little for our listeners what you're talking about?
Sure. So Pavlov is this Russian physiologist, and one day he notices that the dogs in his lab always drool when they see his assistant, and he wonders why. Could it be because the assistant was always the one delivering food to the dog, and the dog had associated the assistant with food? So he tried to always ring a bell when delivering food to the dog. And then guess what?
What?
The dog starts drooling every time it hears the bell, even when the food isn't there.
Like how we start craving chicken nuggets when we see the golden arches. Mm-hmm. And thanks to powerful associative memories, even after the pandemic, when I see a large group of people gathering, I would probably still feel a little bit uneasy because large crowds have been repeatedly associated with danger in all the public health campaigns during the pandemic.
Oh my gosh, that is so true. And I believe the procedural memory of coughing or sneezing into one's elbow will also stay with many of us.
I hope you're right. That would be a great one to remember.
I feel that when we talk about how we will remember the pandemic, a lot of it has to do with declarative or explicit memory. For example, we might remember the day we went to the supermarket and all the toilet paper was gone. Could you talk a little bit about how the things we experience get stored in our brain as memory?
I think you have made a really great point. Let's do that. So things we experience and sense in our daily life, it could be a sound, a sight, a smell, or a touch, or all of them combined. They enter our brains and turn on a number of brain cells in specific sequence, just like a pianist playing a concerto on a piano.
However, on a piano, no matter how many times you play certain keys together, they do not change their shape because a piano has no memory.
You're spot on. And that is the key difference between a piano and our brains. In our brains, the keys that are played together would form a special connection with each other. It's as if after you play the Beethoven Fifth Symphony, bum, 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 when you hear bum, 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 the key for the bum on the piano momentarily become easier to press down.
So what you're saying is if an experience has entered our brain before, the brain cells associated with that experience become more ready to turn on in that specific sequence or pattern.
Exactly. The brain cells that got turned on together become more connected. Like I'm trying to come up with an analogy, maybe like kind of like a string of beads.
As the Canadian psychologist Donald Hebb famously put it, neurons set fire together, wire together. Emily, have you ever tried folding a paper?
Yeah, why?
After you fold a paper, it leaves a mark. And then the next time you fold it, it's more likely to.
Fold along that mark.
Exactly.
I see what you did there. The paper has memory.
And even if you weren't trying to flatten the paper, sometimes it still naturally folds along that mark. Just like when memory replays in your brain for no reason.
I love this analogy.
I have a question though. We see, hear and smell so many things in life. Wouldn't that be like folding the paper a million different ways? In which case, it could be very hard to go back to a specific fold and be certain of it.
So I can see two really critical design questions in what you were asking. The first one would be, how does our brain choose what to store into memory?
Mm-hmm.
And the second one would be, what happens when we try to retrieve our memory?
Absolutely. You're right. Let's start with the first one. If we remember everything in our life, we would quickly run out of space, but we don't seem to remember frivolous details. Although it's not completely up to our free will to choose what to remember. So how does our brain prioritize?
You're absolutely right. Over time, we do forget a lot of things that we experience. However, attention and emotion are two factors that really affect if we remember a certain experience. So things we pay close attention to tend to be remembered better. And if this experience caught us by surprise, had a significant meaning to us, or made us very emotional, we might be able to remember it better.
Oh, so they would create a deeper fold in the paper of our minds.
Exactly. And continuing with this analogy, in our paper that has folded a million times and become very soft, if two folds are very, very close right next to each other on the paper, it can be very hard to tell them apart. Our recall of memory is indeed extremely unreliable or flexible.
It doesn't feel that way, though. We must have decent memory, right? Like, we're able to get through life pretty okay.
Yeah, we are pretty good at remembering the gist of things, but not so great at remembering details. So maybe it is good enough for daily life, but most people's memory is far from perfect, and we tend to be actually more confident of it than we probably should.
Dang.
So each time we recall a piece of memory, we don't simply take out the whole piece like capturing a bird in an aviary. We actually reconstruct the memory by assembling it from traces throughout the brain.
A bit like recreating a paper crane from a piece of paper that had previously been folded into the crane, then taken apart.
Yeah, absolutely. Except the paper had also previously also been folded many times into many other shapes.
That would be challenging.
It is very challenging. And we are very likely to induce distortions when we try to reconstruct a memory. Many people are convinced that they remember every detail of where they were and what they were doing when they heard about 9/11. But when they were asked to recall the dates throughout the span of several years by researchers, the details of their recall changed up to 40%, but they remained incredibly confident of it.
Huh. Are you saying when we remember the pandemic, the memories might not even be accurate?
It almost definitely would not be. So with time, our memories tend to fade from highly specific and detailed to more generalized and vague. Moreover, our minds tend to suppress painful memories or those we're embarrassed by. Therefore, a lot of us tend to look at the past through a rosy glass when we have some distance from that period of time.
Interesting. I can see that being a protective function of our minds.
Absolutely. Although I would also say there is a more nefarious facet to this distortability of our memories, which is that misinformation, propaganda, or censorship can easily alter how we ended up remembering this pandemic in a few years' time.
What do you mean?
So, looking back, it felt like this pandemic was held up in front of our society like a mirror and shed light on a lot of really messed up aspects of how our societies and government function. So, for example, how COVID was initially willfully ignored, how mask wearing was initially dismissed and stigmatized, or how the health of vulnerable groups was readily sacrificed for the economy. Like, I cannot name all of them here, but if you try to think back to the year 2020, you might remember some of these observations yourself.
For sure.
So COVID has provided so many heavy and difficult lessons that we should remember. But those lessons challenge the core of how our societies currently function, and in some cases, the competency and legitimacy of our government. In fact, we have seen examples of memory of disastrous events in history being carefully managed by the government to erase the detailed personal account of the event and promote a certain collective narrative.
I would say what you're describing is historically perhaps most common under authoritarian rule. But I guess even if we think back to democratic countries, there are things that are highly politicized, distorted, or erased.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why I think our memories, our personal narratives during the pandemic are actually so important and valuable. For example, recently, a Chinese TV drama about COVID sparked huge outrage because its depiction of heroic healthcare workers completely erased women healthcare workers and focused entirely on men. And people were posting on social media angrily, saying that we remember so many of the healthcare workers on the front line were actually women, and we don't want to remember differently.
This is so powerful, because our memory can actually be competed with and replaced by narratives we hear and read and public opinion.
Can you maybe tell us a little bit more about how false memories actually get implanted in our brain?
Yeah. It's actually really interesting. So since 1995, which was when researchers first showed the possibility of artificially implanting false memories, and they did this with the assistance of a family member of the test subject, many labs have shown using a technique called false narrative technique that false memory can be implanted. So researchers have shown the possibility of implanting several different types of false memory, including getting lost in a shopping mall, spilling a punch bowl at a family wedding, and even being left in the car as a child and releasing the parking brake so the car rolled onto something.
Wow. First of all, can they not think of anything nicer?
I know.
These are all terrible memories. And some of them would have been very memorable. Are we really that easily fooled? Like, how can these nonsense memories enter our brain and get mistaken as part of our own.
Yeah. Well, one of the most powerful forces for creating a false memory is called inference. Have you ever come across this before?
Okay, tell us, Garrett, what is this?
So it's our brain's natural tendency to fill in blanks by making assumptions about any missing data so that it can generate an overall coherent picture that inevitably includes new details we don't actually remember. Actually, for example, our professor did this in my first lecture on memory in graduate school. So we were shown a list of items: butter, flour, baking soda, salt, eggs, etc. And obviously, all these words can be associated with baking. Later, we were shown a list with a lot of these words, but also other random words, and then asked to pick the ones we'd actually seen. What ended up happening is that a lot of people remembered other words related to baking that actually weren't on the initial list.
That's so interesting. So they generated false memory based on this assumption that they were shown a lot of baking related words, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And we do this all the time in everyday life. Actually, in fact, this was done as an experiment by Roediger and McDermott in 1995. Except instead of baking words, they showed participants 15 words all related to sleep, except the word sleep. As you can imagine, a lot of participants remembered seeing the word sleep. What's fascinating is that people are said to be more susceptible to misremembering when they're experiencing a very intense emotion.
Gosh, this reminds me of what I recently came across when researching for this episode, that inaccurate memory and mistaken eyewitness identification is one of the most common causes of false conviction in the U.S. Eyewitnesses are put under high pressure to remember a crime scene, so a lot of details can easily be false.
Yes, the implication of false memory just by inference or suggestion is really, really dangerous when our criminal justice system relies so heavily on witness reports.
Absolutely. That's why our memories are especially vulnerable in this day and age when we are bombarded with reporting and opinion pieces in the pandemic.
Exactly. And headlines really, really matter. A simple word choice can powerfully shape our memories of an event. For example, in a study, participants watched a video of a traffic accident, and then they were asked what they had observed. One group of participants were asked how fast were the cars going when they hit each other, and another group were asked to describe how fast the cars were going when they smashed into each other. So, subtle change in the words. However, a week later, when they were asked if they remembered seeing any broken glass in the video, the participants who had been asked with the word smash said yes, incorrectly.
Wow, just one word. And the way you remember an incident, it mm-hmm. becomes so different. I think we really need to be really mindful of the sources of information we're being fed and the biases they may come with.
Yes, indeed. When we read news reports about the incidents, we tend to blend that report into our memory of the events. So another source of false memory is actually discussing the incident with other people. The more information that you get about the incident or event, the more likely it is that the original event actually gets distorted in your mind.
So your memory is able to combine elements of the incidents, one that were truly witnessed and one that were heard about later, into a singular comprehensive narrative.
Exactly right.
Oh, so what can we do? Like, can we ever be sure that the details we remembered about the pandemics are true?
So the only way to prove a memory is false is if there are different sources of independent evidence that corroborate the memory or disprove it. Professor Elizabeth Loftus, who pioneered this field, has two suggestions on how to guard against false memory. The big one she suggests is to actually pay attention at the time you're experiencing something and just don't go about it on autopilot. And then the second one is to rehearse it or repeat it.
That's interesting. So do you maybe have any specific suggestions in regards to the pandemic and how we remember it?
Well, something that can be done is something that actually you've been doing a lot of that I know, which is journaling. So recounting how your day went and the emotions that you felt is a great way to reconsolidate the memory of day-to-day living through a pandemic. And to be honest, these are super precious resources so that we don't forget what it was like.
I love that. I actually was reading my diary from a few months ago, and I noticed that I have already forgotten a lot of it if I had not written it down. To be in touch again with the raw emotions of those moments was actually, to me, a very fascinating experience.
Yeah, that's really cool. And the other thing that's been suggested is, just in general, to remember things better is to break up your routine. So keep the way you spend your weekdays different from weekends, and then adjust that routine even slightly to increase the novelty of the experiences. This way, you can remember more clearly by using those events as landmarks in your memory.
Do you think if more of us do these things you mentioned, our collective memory of the pandemic could be better protected?
That's really hard to say, because collective remembering of an event changes with the collective sensibilities of the time. So, for example, a 2013 study showed that while both older and younger Americans listed the bombing of Japan as an important event in the Second World War, older adults who had actually lived through the war saw it as a positive occurrence because it ended the war and spared lives, whereas the younger generation saw it as a negative event as it killed a lot of civilian lives.
That's really interesting. We will definitely continue to make sense of and reflect on this bizarre year of 2020 long after it is done.
Definitely. One of the things that blows my mind is that it's January 2021 now. I distinctly remember sometime during the first lockdown in April of last year, when I was cooped up indoors, I was wondering, when will this pandemic ever end and when will the new year come? Fast forward, and it's 2021 already. Where did July and August and September go? I honestly can't remember a single day during those months. I sometimes wondered if I even lived through it, you know? Where I am, we only had one lockdown, fortunately, but all our lives were completely thrown off routine, even when we went back to work.
Yeah, absolutely. The lockdown throws everything out of the loop, doesn't it?
Yeah. I wish now, like you, I'd kept a journal. And I remember a lot of public institutions encouraging people to record what they were living through. I remember laughing, being like, as if I would ever forget this. Scarily.
Right.
I've gotten a lot of it.
Yeah, time and memory seem to be so interlinked to one another, yet they're really, really fluid.
Mm-hmm.
Recently, I came across this super interesting article that discussed how even people with highly superior autobiographical memory are now having trouble with dates from quarantine. So these are people who can remember the date they went to see a particular movie 10 years ago, or can describe in vivid detail what they did on a very specific day last year. But even they seem to be drawing blanks remembering dates during quarantine. So what's with that?
Yeah, that's really, really fascinating. The constriction of living in some form of lockdown has seemed to mess with the two things you mentioned, our perception of time and our memory of it.
Yeah, I know you've been reading into it. So why is our perception of the time of lockdown so messed up?
So for humans, it seems that what is more important than how long a day is objectively is how long we feel it is. So when we're judging how long the duration is between two events, we can either make that judgment prospectively or retrospectively. So in prospective timing, we do not know how long an upcoming event or activity will take, while in retrospective judgments, we're using our memory to remember how long something took. Now, as you can imagine, in prospective timing, we're anticipating the event. So for example, I was looking forward to 2021 when we were in lockdown. What scientists have found is that when you're estimating the time to the event, if you allocate a lot more attention to it, then the duration feels a lot longer.
That's so interesting. So we perceive time to be longer if we pay more attention to it, like that proverb that a watched kettle never boils.
Exactly right. Just as a detour on how subjective time perception is, do you remember when you were a kid? we had, you know, about 8 weeks of summer holidays that just go on and on forever and ever. But then as we aged, it just seemed to speed up.
Yeah, now 8 weeks just fly by.
Yeah, that actually has a lot to do with attention to events and how we perceive time unfolding. Young children perceive everything in real time, so they're extremely engaged and aware, paying attention to every single stimulus, because they're constantly getting a lot of new stimulus that they haven't seen before. So their brains are paying attention to taking all that information so that it can develop and manage behavior. As we go through childhood and adolescence, time goes slower because we're paying a lot more attention to it.
I see. And I guess also for children, they're receiving many more new stimuli and experiences than as adults, so that they're more engaged and aware that a lot more is happening. And so time moves more slowly because they are paying attention to all the things that are happening.
Exactly. And actually, that's a brilliant segue to the other part of how we perceive time. The other part of how we perceive time has to do with novelty. So, as you were saying, children dedicate more neural resources to the present moment because they're receiving stimuli that is all new, experiences that they haven't gone through previously. Adults, on the other hand, frequently experience the same stimuli over and over again. The brain then ends up treating these previously seen stimuli as practically invisible because it's been seen before and it's already been mapped. This is what's known as neural adaptation.
I see what you mean. There are things I can do now, like cutting vegetables or doing some tasks where I'm like disengaged or not paying attention in a moment to the task.
Yeah. For example, think of a child riding a bicycle versus an adult. As an adult, you can ride while listening to music or chatting to a friend. But as a child, you needed to devote a lot more resources to that activity.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess if you think about it, novel situation or stimuli means that you are paying attention to it more, or you need to devote more mental resource to it. So time will likely feel like it's going slower.
Bingo. And so novelty plays a key role in how we remember how long an event or the interval between two events in the past was, i.e. retrospective judgment of time that we were discussing.
So retrospective judgment of time is when we look back to remember how long something was, right?
Yep. The brain relies on memory to estimate the duration between two events in the past. So the brain uses something called temporal landmarks. The human brain and memory formation seems to have a need to organize our lives into stories and narrative arcs. Our memory timelines need a before and an after. So these landmarks are intense moments in your life. So going back to children versus adult perception of time, as you rightly said, for children, they have a lot more novel experiences compared to adults. Therefore, it feels like that vacation was really so very long.
I can see how the lockdown is really gonna mess with this.
Right? What the lockdown has done is to mush the days together. So no matter how many old friends you reconnected with or how many Zoom wine and cheese nights you had, they're all physically monotonous. You're in front of a computer. What's more, according to Dr. Barbara Tversky, the novelty of an experience also has a lot to do with the physical space. Our brains record new experience in the context of physical space way more vividly. So during lockdown, when you're stuck in the same place, an aspect of that novelty is lost, no matter how many new things you find to do.
I miss traveling. So what you're saying is that there's less novelty to anchor your memories. So how do other things like the stress and anxiety play into this whole time perception and memory formation thing?
Good question. I think we're still trying to understand aspects of that. What we know is that anxiety can disrupt the perception of time. So in some very interesting experiments done way back in the 70s, scientists showed that when people are asked to wait for an event to occur and the event is anxiety inducing, then they tend to overestimate how long that waiting time takes.
Didn't even have diagnosed anxiety disorders, right?
No, they didn't. The event itself was causing the anxiety. The lockdown is anxiety inducing in many aspects because we can't physically move around much. We have to work from home for a lot of us. There's a lot of uncertainty about the future, about our work, etc. And then, of course, added to all of this is the anxiety of actually getting COVID.
Yeah, I think the worst part is we don't know when it will end. I mean, it just keeps dragging on. They said when the vaccines are here, but even vaccines rollout might take a year to complete.
Yeah, exactly. And this temporal uncertainty of when we can go back to normal adds a lot of stress.
Yeah, so in essence, by disrupting our set pre-pandemic routine, increasing anxiety, and basically increasing monotony of day-to-day existence, what this pandemic has done is to warp our perception of time and mush our memories of this pandemic into one long period of I can't remember doing much except some calls.
Yeah, exactly. That's so beautifully summed up. And I think with that, that's all we have time for in this episode today. I think we've discussed all that we wanted to. Thank you for listening. We hope this has been useful and helpful to you. If you like this podcast and want to support us, please give us a good review on the podcasting platform you use. That would really help other people to see it. We're also on Facebook at NeuroJunkies, so please do get in touch with us there.
We'd really love to hear from you. And we are nearing the end of this season with one more episode to go. So please join us next time for The Brain on COVID-19 as we explore the havoc this virus is wreaking on the brain. We hope you stay safe, take care of yourself and each other. Bye.
Bye.